Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yeah, so our speakers today are Jenna Crean Ashton. She's a PhD student in Arts History and Visual Studies. And she's a Storytime veteran. And she's going to talk about Rachel Whiteread's Storytime. And then we're going to have Sophie Preston and Wendy Ligon-Smith. That's going to be reading along with Proust. Sophie can't actually be here, unfortunately, so she sends her apologies, so Wendy's going to be doing twice the work. Rosie and I are then going to discuss a reading survey.
Carriage return.
That looks at people's reading habits from 50 different people. And we've entitled that Mostly I Read on the Toilet, so that should be fun. And then Gary's going to, he's a history PhD student, and he's going to be looking at the Ryland and its readers after Borges. And we're also looking to have film introductions. Life Libraries from Amanda Bell and Tara from an arts collective, Kinocophone. She's an independent researcher. And then there's a film at the end by Gary Dunbill, who is an independent filmmaker and
carriage return
motion graphics designer. And we'll do that before discussions. And I think that's about it. I'm going to shut up and allow Jenna to do some talking.
So Rachel Whiteread's print Storytime 2008 is created for the House of Fairy Tales portfolio. It sets up its own fairy tale or creepy childhood storytelling scene, as gleefully described in the catalogue. Enchantment and disenchantment filter through Whiteread's other strangely inverted sculptural spaces, but Storytime makes a distinct connection to those literary narratives we inherently associate with our childhood fears, dreams and desires. It's a visualisation of the process of reading, of storytelling, but through those objects of the dollhouse which evoke curiosity and fantastical imaginings. I draw an analogy between the miniatureness of the dollhouse, that self-contained space, a centre within a centre, within, within, within. The dollhouse is a materialised secret, and the book, that paper locket which captures secrets within its pages. The book and the dollhouse are both objects of contained fantasy, a mode of creating another world. Whiteread's Storytime offers a world within a world, within, within, within. What narratives are being shared in this scene? What delights or horrors are being enacted out by the storyteller through the process of reading? A seemingly innocent image, in Storytime, an extended family of miniature dolls congregates in front of the fire around Granny with her hooded dress and red leather-bound book. The interior is a modern white-walled box of a room, but the dolls themselves are a shabby collection. The children are dirtied and soiled and of varying scales. The adults are little more than stitched rags, their faces painted on, their smiles inky and crooked. Storytime is a disconcerting visual narrative. We are presented with a quaint scenario of family-loving, discussion-sharing, but all is silent and rigidly motionless. The dolls, objects of human disposal and manipulation, are forced into participating in a communal family event of story time. Child figures, bounded and constrained in their high chairs, stare forward as adult figures, tired and worn, slump in their spaces, all dutifully playing out their part in this tableau. The family unit is disintegrating, but Granny continues, seemingly oblivious, delivering the story time narrative which binds these figures together. Storytime acts as a pictorial snapshot of an uneasy domestic family unit, one perhaps seething with secretive desires and aggressions. Storytime is also reminiscent of Whiteread's other work, Place, an installation of collected dollhouses. In Darkness, the interiors of the dollhouses are more prominent than the exteriors. We are invited, or forced, into a voyeuristic game of imagining the activities within the lit rooms. One such activity, it seems, is reading and storytelling. I was always intrigued by the miniature model villages my grandparents would take me to visit on the Kent coast. Little faces of static wooden figures peering out from the stone windows would follow my lumbering little girl footsteps, as I was careful not to tread on 6-inch wide manicured front lawns, displace the skittles on the village green, or accidentally knock over the dog standing near a park bench. I had read The Borrowers. I knew that as soon as I turned away, they would shift rapidly between the houses, the bakery and the grocers, thinking I wouldn't notice, of course. If you stared long enough, you'd see one blink. Even toy figures have to let their guard down sometimes. When I was 6, my mother, pregnant, and her father designed and built a dollhouse for me, partly to house my ever-increasing collection of dolls, but to also pacify the lightly jealous feelings of a 6-year-old evoked by the birth of a new baby. It is a structure of 3 levels, the lower level a dining, living room, a bathroom, a kitchen on the second floor, and a large bedroom in the roof space, a neo-Georgian facade, with white window frames and pale pink plaster effect exterior ply walls. A delicate cut balustrade staircase winds its way through. Each step and rail is tolerantly painted, the roof panel decorated with individually cut tiles laid in a fish scale type arrangement. The interior, a scaled down replica of the real life 1980s family decor, Laura Ashley floral peach colour paintwork, carpet sourced from DIY offcuts. and accessories to match. The interior and painted exterior has altered since. The removable facade was discarded on one of the various house moves. It fell off, its magnetic clip strip demagnetised from overuse. The dollhouse now sits in the corner of a bedroom as a space of display more than an object of play, but exists mainly as a memory of a child-parent relation, of a mother's desire, patience and talent in producing a gift for her daughter, as evidence of a father-daughter collaboration and meeting of minds, a passing on of skills, the desired pacification of a jealous sibling. With all appliances scaled to the correct height and width, my dolls, they also had their own miniature books. All perfectly in scale, their type font neatly arranged within the half-inch measurements of the binding. And they were fairy tales. Little Red Riding Hood, Gold Locks, Jack and the Beanstalk. My dolls' reading habits were fantastical. Non-fiction did not adorn their shelves. Miniaturisation enables us to create alternative microcosms in which dreams, fantasies and fears can be enacted out without fear of reprisal or unbalancing the status quo. Children can make objects sing, dance, love and hate. The neutral space of adult display becomes vulnerable to imperfect desire and fantasy, hidden secrets and rituals. I was fascinated by these Lilliputian books, so much more desirable and interesting than full-scale child-sized versions. I would squint by the lamplight to attempt to read over the tiny pages and would trace my nail over delicate illustrations. Years later, I would come across a cabinet of such miniature books in a dusty second-hand bookshop, gloriously named Scrivener's. The dolls have been deprived of their reading material.
So I've kind of embraced the casual tone that storytelling implies, so hopefully it won't put you off and make you feel awkward. Hopefully it's fun and casual and we'll learn more about Proust together. So just to introduce you to Proust and his novel, he wrote most of In Search of Lost Time from 1909 to 1922 when he died from poor health. And because of his severe asthma and allergies, most of the novel was actually written in bed. This may be something that you've heard of or seen parodied often. And his writing habits, you see here an example of one of his manuscripts. With the help of his housemaid and his caretaker, Celeste Albury, he continued to add on to and to rework his novel to the point of sewing in extra panels of paper onto the manuscripts. And even furthermore, much to his editor's dismay, he continued to add and change the manuscripts even after they went to the printers. And this is actually already after he had been rejected by several publishers. He's testing it really here. He's finally got an editor, and then he's doing this sort of thing to the Proofs. So volume one of his massive novel was published in 1913, and that's titled Swan's Way, coming up here on the big 100-year anniversary. So this is something Sophie and I are looking at exploring further. So though the novel would eventually be published in its entirety, much of it was published post-mortem, and Proust continued to edit his manuscript even as he was on his deathbed. So there's a lot of disputes about authority, what should have been included and what is included, and maybe shouldn't be there, actually. So that's just part of the context surrounding Proust's novel. And in the past 100 years of the readership of Proust, there's been kind of a steady stream of interest, you know, with revivals here and there for different reasons why people would want to return to this novel. It has this reputation of being for the snobbish, the francophiles, you know, anyone obsessed with Frenchness. It also gets a pretty bad reputation for being difficult to read. Maybe you found this if you attempted reading Proust. He's extremely difficult to read. He has these ridiculously long sentences that go on and on. Some of them can go for a whole page. And they also are known to describe the upper class. They're about the elite people. And it's not really in touch with reality, was one of the things it's accused of. Also, to read such a massive novel, you have to be one of those people with all of this leisure time. And so these are all obstacles in getting to Proust, in reading Proust, why we might not bother reading Proust. So I've assembled here a few quotes that I'd like to share with you about different people who have ventured to read Proust, things that have to do with the attitude of coming to Proust. So Jane Birkin said, "My mother was right. When you've got nothing left, all you can do is get into silk underwear and start reading Proust." So you get a hint there of what type of people are reading Proust and how they're reading their Proust. There's also other end of the spectrum. We have Germaine Greer. If you haven't read Proust, don't worry. This lacuna in your cultural development you do not need to fill. On the other hand, if you have read All of à la recherche du temps perdu, you should be very worried about yourself. As Proust very well knew, reading his work for as long as it takes is temps perdu, time wasted, time that would be better spent visiting a demented relative, meditating, walking the dog, or learning ancient Greek. And then this is another interesting little cultural interpretation of Proust. I think it'll tie into what you guys are doing with the survey later. There was a survey taken about which books are most commonly lied about, or which books do most people say they've read that they haven't. This novel ranks number 8 out of all the novels that they surveyed people about. And even in the list of the top 10, the editor couldn't help themselves from writing a comment beside Proust. She writes, "Has anyone actually read this other than Proust? I plan to finish this about the same time as I lose 20 pounds, completely organize my life, and become an all-around perfect person." Lastly, I'll give you a quote from Phyllis Rose's memoir. She wrote this memoir, The Year of Reading Proust. And echoing the opening line of Proust's novel, which starts, "For a long time I went to bed early," she starts her memoir, "For a long time I used to try to read Proust." So you get this feeling that people attempt Proust. It's monumental, it's difficult, and that it's filled with failure in a way. Why attempt such a massive novel? It's such a hard read. And so even Proust's most devoted readers fail in a way, that you can't faithfully read the novel. Roland Barthes said, "It's Proust's good fortune, from one reading to the next, we never skip the same passages." So even Roland Barthes, devoted to Proust, you have to skip passages. There's no way you can read the whole thing. So why do we read Proust, and how do we read Proust? Is something Sophie and I are interested in, and I'll read here some of her writing that she'd like to share. Proust's long sentences that record every moment and every sensation attempt to simultaneously capture and leave to evolve the gesticulations of the novel's protagonists. The sweet aftertaste of the Madeleine lingers on Marcel's tongue for 80 pages. Walter Benjamin writes how the reader is no longer the listener but the daydreamer. The daydreamer who not only sees but creates, who writes along with Proust. Lydia Davis, who is someone I'll come back to in a few minutes, remarks that contemporaries of Proust have suggested that he spoke the way that he wrote. One friend, although surely exaggerating, reported that Proust would deliver one long sentence, full of asides, parentheses, directions, corrections, marginal notes, and this was in an attempt to capture every nuance of a piece of reality to reflect, perhaps, entire thought. As readers, we feel Proust's own struggle for breath, his desire, in Mallarmé's terms, to prevent the flowers that fall from my mouth turning into toads, end quote. Embedded into Proust's draft manuscripts, you see here, of the novel are nearly 100 drawings as he wrote. And this is something Sophie's very interested in and doing really interesting work on. These can be seen in the margins of the text, superimposed over the text, on blank pages within the body of the text, and attached to pages by a hinge. In these doodles, we see the writer dawdle, perhaps even struggle. They evoke what anthropologist Michael Tosi calls the terror of writing, or rather the writer's fear that the more one writes, the more reality is actually being pushed off the page. Proust's doodles fill in for moments of inarticulation and gesture painful pleasure of what it is to be in the process of writing. But back to reading. Poring over Proust's effusive prose is also a struggle suffused with pleasure. Proust encourages the reader to lose their breath, to trip over words, and quicken their pace in an attempt to be in the novel, to take pleasure from being in the search. Roland Barthes, whose writings are heavily informed by Proust, teaches us to be writerly readers, to embrace the inherent performativity of writing. As we read, we do not listen to Proust's text, we perform alongside it. And here you see Sophie's performance alongside Proust. Usurping by writing along with the author involves the theater of emotions rather than the clarity of messages. Reading for me involves the scribbling over the text, a folding down pages and a gesturing when breathlessly read aloud. In essence, reading Proust involves a bodily response. And that ends Sophie's portion of the text there. But this idea that we perform along with Proust, we write in the margins, we're writerly readers, we participate, that's something that, it's not specifically Proustian, but it's quintessentially Proustian, if I can put it that way. So this idea of a bodily response is also a personal response. Andre Osterman did a fascinating book called The Proust Project, where he assembled various Proust scholars and got them to kind of give their initial responses and their initial interpretations, which are just really bound in the personal experience of reading Proust. The whole project actually starts with his own anecdote about the first time he read Proust and the first time he saw it and the first time he encountered it. And so that's kind of the lead that I will follow. I'm going to share some of my experiences with Proust. And so for me, personally, there's an in-betweenness of Proust's novel that attracts me to it. He wrote a novel that captures the in-betweenness of the time between the 19th and 20th centuries, between the old aristocracy and the new bourgeois, between horse and carriages and automobiles and flight, between the Belle Epoque and trench warfare. The novel is also in-between genres, the narrator's name, Marcel, being the same as the author's, and the cast of characters in the novel have been linked to several of Proust's acquaintances, and that leads people to read In Search of Lost Time as an autobiography. The plot is, after all, about a narrator finally discovering that his life dream is to be a writer. But Proust himself denied that the book was an autobiography, and it is contested whether the portion that uses the name Marcel was actually added in his lifetime or posthumously. Also, for us English readers, we read in translation. You don't have to go far to hear someone say, "Ah, oh, but you haven't read Proust till you read him in French." So, in a way, we're between his language and our language. I've been dedicated to my Moncrief translation, which has gone out of style for most English-speaking Proust readers who prefer the fresher translation offered by Lydia Davis and company, published less than 10 years ago. My translation is left between Proust's original French and the new definitive English translation, which is how they're marketing that one. But I hold on to my Moncrief translation out of nostalgia for it. It's the first version of Proust I ever read. I can't stand for the new translation to change certain sentences that they've been so etched in my memory. For instance, in the crucial and often parodied scene with the Madeleine, my Moncrief translation describes the shell-shaped cake as being, quote, "so richly sensual under its severe religious folds." Really nice, yeah? Okay, so Lydia Davis's translation has turned it to "so fatly sensual with its severe and pious pleating." So I can't stand that it's new. I can't stand that it's different. So it's my personal an encounter with the text that leads me to be so indebted and stuck in this old translation. So in this book about memory, I'm indebted to my translation because of my own memories being tied to it. I first came to Proust at an in-between time in my own life. I had just finished my bachelor's degree and was deciding whether or not to undertake a master's. I was in between undergrad and grad school. I also just injured my knee and was ordered to rest, mainly in bed, for 6 weeks, plenty of leisure time, the time afforded by injury or illness to read Proust. Like the author, I sat in bed with the novel. The first time I read Swan's Way, I underlined and wrote in the margins with pencil, noting especially the scenes of the jealous Charles Swan hunting around Paris for his teasingly unfaithful lover, Odette. In those days, I had just began dating my now husband, and I remember identifying with various scenes in the novel about the desire for the chase of that always out-of-reach love. And I see the same kinship in the essays of my students that were reading Swan's Way for the first time last semester. The girls seem to know so much more about the cloying and manipulative tricks of Odette, while the boys seem to fall for her tricks all over again, the same way that Swan did. Proust's novel was different each time I read him with a new group of people. Carol Maver drew out the sensuality of the language and the beauty of the novel's meandering structure. My fellow master's students on a Proust course at Duke University were quick to point out hints of racial and class-based prejudice, whilst our professor expertly read religious identities. And now that my PhD is anchored in Venice, the research for it, I'm particularly drawn to the way that the narrator idealizes that city and describes it with unabashed admiration. You can see I've graduated to pen in the margins as well. So there's this way that the transience of pencil in my gesture becomes much more confident as I'm confident in my relationship with Proust. I've moved on to pen. So now when I go back to read Proust, my memories are intertwined with the memories of the narrator, readers' thoughts laid onto authors, mine and Proust's thoughts entangled. I return to Proust's novel because, as he does with each reader, he has made me a part of it. Thank you.
Okay, so my friend Judy Harris designed this survey. She's doing a PhD, but this is really more of a kind of personal interest of hers because she's fascinated by how reading changes our experience of the world. I think something that came across in Amanda's film is that the library has such a distinctive atmosphere, and I always think maybe that's because everyone's sort of sending out thoughts into the air. We're just going to read through a small selection of the answers, and with some of the questions we'll throw it out to the floor. So if you're feeling interactive, then just say something. Take it away.
Okay. On average, how often do you read for pleasure, on a daily or weekly basis?
Daily. On the way to work, in the bath on the weekends, and before going to bed.
Not enough. About once or twice a day, for example, newspapers or supplements, and 3 times a week, novels.
Almost daily.
4 times.
I try to daily, but go in fits and spurts. Some weeks I will read every night. Sometimes I go for weeks without reading.
Is there a particular place in your house that you like to sit and read or lie down, etc.?
Sitting on the kitchen floor. Often lying down on the living room couch, on the balcony when the weather's good.
I mostly read on my bed if I'm at home, but if I'm commuting or waiting somewhere, chances are there's a book in my hand.
On the sofa with sunlight streaming through the window, or in bed.
My bed. If I had a lovely armchair, I'd be there. I like the feeling that a place is a special reading place.
In my old house, I read in a chair by my bedroom window. I only read in my bedroom for peace, but the danger is I get sleepy when I read on my bed.
The couch, the toilet, and bed when I get the chance.
So does anyone else have a special reading place?
Yeah,
no?
My husband lets me.
Where's that?
In bed.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of conflict in the survey about like husbands wanting the light off or girlfriends being annoying. Yeah. Okay. Do you ever go to a pub or cafe specifically to sit and read on your own, i.e. not to read whilst waiting for someone?
On a Saturday after a swim, go down to the cafe and have a little read.
Sometimes. I make deliberate stops on my way to and from places so as to be able to read.
Yes. I'm better at reading in public places. I will go there to read so as not to have any distractions. Computer, TV, people.
When are you most likely to read? For example, evening, Sunday morning, on holiday?
On holiday, evening and quiet times, when my computer isn't around.
I like reading in bed just before I go to sleep. Otherwise, it's also nice to do just before or after work in the kitchen or the lounge.
Holiday and Sundays and daytime. That is, I like going for it rather than only doing it a bit in the morning. Also, it's a bit too much of a winding down activity to be able to start the day with, unless you're reading on the way to work, which is an entirely different thing. I'd like to do more evening and bed reading, but because I have to move my eyes, it just makes them close and go to sleep.
Are there times when it's much harder to read? For example, when you're breaking up with someone, or if someone close to you has died, or if you're particularly happy or sad?
I still read when there's something wrong, but most of the time nothing sinks in. I read several chapters before I realise I don't know what's just happened.
I think being more emotional in any way makes reading more attractive. The things that make me want to watch TV are feeling tired, deflated and unimaginative.
When I broke up with Ben, I didn't really read for a year. When I have man trouble, when I'm anxious, I can't concentrate.
Best time to read is probably when depressed, as books are preferable to life. When happy, it's harder to read.
Depends on the book. I read things like Harry Potter when I'm sad, because you don't have to concentrate on the language and it's a return to somewhere safe.
Okay, do you sit and read with your friends or partner?
No, I happen to read alone.
Growing up, my best friend and I used to sit and read together for hours. I'm not sure why, actually.
Yes, both with my partner or family, though. I don't like that.
Yes, just before bed, the two of us read at the same time, and often out loud to each other. We've developed a shared story time, which may sound childish, but is actually lovely.
I've tried to initiate this. No, is unfortunately the answer. Do you read a lot of books from a particular genre, or fiction, non-fiction?
Okay, this is a really long answer. I'm going to do it. I used to only read fiction up to about 4 years ago until I met someone who only ever read non-fiction books. He told me he didn't understand why a person needed to read fiction when there is so much going on, has really happened, that's so interesting. Since that conversation, I started picking up non-fiction books as well, and now would say that to every 2 fiction books, I'll read 1 non-fiction. In terms of non-fiction, I enjoy history books, predominantly Western and European history. Fiction-wise, I don't have a genre that I read a lot. I'm more fixated on certain authors, but I have developed a liking of historical fiction, as it combines fiction and non-fiction. I'm likely to read science fiction fantasy whilst on holiday. I'd probably say I tend to jump all over the place in terms of the fiction I read, though I usually tend to stay away from the blockbusters. I also stay away from the schmaltzy romance novels, anything with a female readership in mind, e.g. Marion Keane's Bridget Jones. Don't like biographies or anything that passes for self-help. Okay.
So, do you usually read books by people of the same race, gender, nationality as yourself?
I've rarely considered the question before. However, there are a surprising amount of books on my shelves that are by white men, so something's probably going on there, and it probably isn't good.
I often build an image of the characters in my head based on their dialogue. Different dialogues form further illustration of the mental image I have, and usually the last thing I think of is skin colour.
Lol, an awkward question. But now you say it, I probably read more books from my own nationality for pleasure. I'm not sure why.
Mostly Western, mostly dead.
Okay, do you read young adult or children's books? If so, do you admit it to other people?
I read Harry Potter, and I always will.
Yes, I love the Morganville vampire series. It's my guilty pleasure, and yes, I'll admit it.
No, but sometimes I will read picture books when I'm waiting for someone in a bookshop.
When you read a book, do you tend to see the characters' faces? If it depends on the book, please say how frequently you picture their face.
Definitely depends on the book. While reading Game of Thrones, I found it incredibly difficult to picture each person's face, as there were so many characters. So when I was just over a third of the way through the book, I watched the pilot episode of the HBO adaptation to get a clearer picture of the characters, and that helped me carry on through the book.
No, not really. It's something I always struggle to do. I think I feel their aura more, if that makes sense and doesn't sound too new age.
Face, yes, but rather fuzzily. Hair, definitely.
Kind of linked to that. If a book is made into a film, can you read it or reread it without picturing the actors as the characters?
Sadly, no. Sad face.
As I'm reading the book, the film people often fade away.
Generally speaking, I don't enjoy seeing films of books I've read. I don't specify the looks and the clothing of characters. To me, the danger of film is that you have to arrange the buttons of Mr. Darcy's waistcoat. Whereas reading, you can simply enjoy the essence and attraction that Mr. Darcy holds for Elizabeth Bennet. Okay, now Gary's going to talk to us about the Rylan Dennett readers.
Yes, Simon, yes, thanks very much. So, this is a story of reading something when you should be reading something else, but mainly it's a story of readers and of multiple acts of reading and intentions to read, so it's quite kind of digressive, and it's quite autobiographical, as it's about my kind of attempts to read as a historian, but then as the author that I've alluded to in the title, sort of after Borges, as once written, he says that all stories are essentially autobiographical, so I've taken that as my, I guess, my brief. So I thought of 3 things when I thought about the story I wanted to tell here. And the third thing I thought about was the worst book I've ever read, which is Beatrice and Virgil by Jan Martel Markwood. And I mean, talk about after Borges, I mean, when you read it after Borges, I mean, it just gets even worse. But anyway, it's got one redeeming feature. And its redeeming feature for me is that it reproduces the act of reading in a textual form in a way that has probably been written off before, but I just can't remember where I've read it. And what he does is this. So the character sends some kind of text, and so he's reading the text. But instead of just reproducing the whole of the text, what he does is he sort of reproduces the bits of the text that he actually reads, and he puts in the ellipsis, the 3 little dots, to show these sort of spaces. And I quite like this, because what it does is, I suppose, sort of entering the notion of these sort of digressions you go on when you read, these sort of spaces that open up between what you thought you were going to read and then these unexpected thoughts that come out of what it is that you end up reading. And the second thing I thought about was Borges' most famous story, which is The Library of Babel. And I mean, to talk about a plot is almost redundant, really, when you're talking about Borges. But I guess the basic idea is that it's written from the perspective of an old man who is so obviously Borges. And I think the thing that annoys me about Beatrice and Virgil is that it comes up with a sort of meta, oh, well, it's not really about me, but actually it totally is Jan Martel, and he just comes up with a plot. Anyway, so The Library of Babel, and he sort of describes this ancient scholar, and he's in a library, And the library can also be taken as a metaphor for the universe, and he sort of plays with this notion of, well, is it a real library, is it a metaphor, and so on. And he writes of a fundamental law of the library, in that in the vast library there are no two identical books. And he goes on to talk about these sort of seemingly impossible and fantastical ideas. So he talks of thousands and thousands of false catalogues, commentaries on commentaries on commentaries, and my personal favourite, the true story of your own death. But the first thing I thought of was a source I'd not found a place for in my work. And this source was the vast, almost infinite archive of the reader's tickets, or reader's application forms, as their official title is. But I guess I just like a ticket to read more than I like a reader's application form, which is why I used it as a title. But anyway, I digress. When I say almost infinite as an archive of these reader's tickets, I'm not really joking. So between when the Rylands open, I should say I work on the Rylands as my PhD, this is my sort of thing. When the Rylands opened in December 1899, January 1900, to when it was taken over by the University of Manchester in May 1972, it issued 55,139 tickets. And I think one of the most curious things, thinking back, is that in this sort of post-1972 statistics, when I joined the library to read, and when I applied to read in 2009, I ended up adding to this enormous archive that I didn't even know existed, that I didn't even know I would be working on, and that I would need to use at some point. And it's, I mean, you can either read that sort of Borgesian or sort of Kafkaesque, I mean, depending on your kind of worldview. And I think one of the most challenging things about working on the Rylands is that it's a building that I end up spending a lot of time in, that I spend a lot of time reading in, but it's also a building that I'm trying to read whilst I'm within it. So, I mean, you get these metaphors of being lost in a good book. Well, I'm lost in a book in a library that I'm trying to read about, and it's these sort of impossible sort of perspectives that kind of Borges talks about. And I think one of the most curious aspects is when you're working on the fourth floor in this sort of glass box, and it's this kind of impossible space. I remember once reading the architectural plans of the building, and I was looking at the building and the plan, and it's that sort of moment when you're trying to sort of raise the imagination beyond, well, actually, I need to sort of read sort of this without the building being there, and it's just impossible. But one of the most curious things that happens is that you get sort of visitors sort of turn up on this almost forbidden fourth floor, and they sort of tap tentatively on the glass, and the archivist lets them in. And they sort of lean over to the archivist and they say, can you tell me, was this ever a church? Was it ever a cathedral? And what strikes me about this is that, I guess, you know, sometimes I've read and I just think, oh, just read the panels, just read about the library. But depending on what you've already read, and what you've already read in terms of buildings, in terms of books and stories about things, I guess it's a sort of basic assumption to think, well, yeah, I suppose when you read this building, it could be a cathedral. But anyway, when I first came across the reader's tickets, I was meant to be reading something else. What I was meant to be reading was this large collection of newspaper cuttings on the Rylands, because I was doing a chapter about the Rylands and the role from about 1900 to 1924. And thinking now, actually, this is just another collection of readers, so there's just hundreds of thousands of readers that I'm dealing with. But then I found these reader's tickets, and I had to read them. And they're just these sort of small cards, but I think what I really like about them is that they not only put a sort of name and a sort of individual sense of, I suppose, sort of individual bodies to these sort of ghosts of readers past that it's quite hard to imagine when you're in the library. It also gives you exactly where they were living at the time, so I could sort of do an enormous sort of map if I wanted to about sort of the distribution of readers. But the thing that I really liked was that each applicant had to state, as the form says, the purpose for which admission is sought, as the application form puts it. So in other words, what do you want to read in the Rylands? Why are you here? And I guess when I came across this source, what really struck me about it, why I had to read it, even though I was really meant to be reading something else, was that it almost seemed sort of Borgesian, in that it was just this impossible source. I thought, here's some information that I never thought I could possibly ever have access to. And so here's just a handful of the readers that I come across. And I look back at my notes, and I didn't look at all 55,139. I looked at a sort of representative sample. And I looked at my notes and I picked out these four. And thinking about this talk, I couldn't actually work out what it was until I sort of put it through both Borges and Martel. So the first reader is Gladys from Chadderston Oldham, who was a student at the university. And she applied to be a reader on the 12th of January 1916. And she writes, for to study to gain access to an admission to books not in other libraries. And I think it's an interesting way into sort of the perception of the Rylands, because in 1892 it acquires the Althorpe collection of books, which is one of the world's and one of the world's most esteemed sort of collections, which I think ran to around 260,000 books. And then in 1900 it acquires the Crawford Muniments, which is where it gets most of its sort of ancient manuscripts from. So we're talking hundreds of thousands of extremely rare volumes. And the second reader, Joseph, a painter and decorator from Ardwick, who applies to be a reader on the 30th of October 1912, his sole purpose, he lists, is just knowledge. And I just want this idea of, yeah, I just want knowledge, just knowledge. And I really sort of, you know, I can really sort of relate to this. And there's quite a lot from this period that just simply says, you know, I just want to use for study, quite a lot of university students. But then we get people like Logarus Kornowski. I wish my name was Logarus Kornowski. Who applies to be, he's from Cheetham Hill. And he applies to be a reader on the 4th of October 1918. And he just puts, reading in all things, specifically classics, modern languages and literature. And I mean, it just kind of makes a mockery of this sort of academic specialisation. So my PhD is just on this single building during a single period of time. And yeah, there's sort of hundreds of contexts I could read into it, but I just sort of the idea of, and I'm a really big fan myself in my own reading practice, of just reading across as many different sort of disciplines and genres as possible. I guess like the sort of the verbose response to that sort of questionnaire. But my absolute favourite of the readers in terms of why she wanted to read here is Ada from Fallowfield, who applies in the 15th of July 1918, so almost at the end of the First World War. And she says she wants to read books in connection with the subject of universal peace. And I just think it's such a wonderful idea, sort of coming to this sort of, you know, kind of hallowed place, sort of outside of the world, sort of almost outside of time. And yeah, I guess, why did I pick these readers? And I think it's almost to do with expectation, because I think subconsciously, I was clearly expecting some other types of people to be using the library, from what I'd read in the historiographies, so sort of many sort of clergy figures and academics at the university and so on. But then thinking back, I guess that's just exactly the same as when people knock on the fourth floor and they sort of say, was this ever a church? Was it ever a cathedral? I mean, you can't really assume what people want to do. And then you think back to the fundamental law of Borges' library. He talks about how there's no two books are identical. No two readers are identical, and likewise, no two historians are identical. If there was another version of me, another version of this room, another universe, he would have picked four completely different readers. And I think the final thought, really, is just to go back to the sort of Martel's ellipses, these spaces in the text to be read. And I think about these kind of, all of these statements of what they wanted to read, what they applied to read in the library, and I think about, well, what were those sort of thoughts, those kind of digressions that they had from these basic principles of what they wanted to read. But then, I don't know, I think I can't help but think of this place as sort of Borgesian now, so I reckon those kind of sources and that kind of knowledge, I mean, it must be in here somewhere.